Today's show is sponsored by Hexabuild. Started by IPv6 experts to drive worldwide adoption of IPv6, Hexabuild is the IPv6 training, education, and consulting company. If your projects include cloud, IoT, security, or, of course, networking, you will need IPv6, and Hexabuild is here to help you deploy and manage it successfully. Get training from some of the most knowledgeable and experienced IPv6 experts in the industry, instructors who literally wrote the books on IPv6. Head over to hexabuild.io to learn more. You can simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. Want to get started with Linode today? You can get $100 in free credit just for listeners of the Day 2 Cloud podcast. Just go to linode.com/day2cloud. That's D-A-Y, the number 2, cloud. Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Today, we're going to be having a great conversation with April Edwards all about DevOps. And what I want to do before we get into the conversation is just let you know that the DevOps clock has not struck midnight. You're not as far behind as you might feel you are. Yes, technology is accelerating like crazy, but it's never too late to get on the DevOps train and move your career or your organization forward. So that was like my main takeaway of this episode. Ethan, what stuck out to you?
I'm going to keep this really, really short, Ned. Failing fast is okay as long as you've shifted left. And I'm not even going to explain that. Just going to let that hang because it was a really cool part of our conversation today.
Oh, yeah. Let's let that be an awesome mystery that you get to explore later. So I'd like to welcome to the show April Edwards. She is a senior software engineer at Microsoft and passionate about this DevOps thing. Am I pronouncing that right, April?
You are. DevOps is the right pronunciation.
Oh, good. Okay, excellent. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself, like encapsulate your entire life in the next 30 seconds, and then we'll talk about DevOps?
Sure. So I'm a senior software engineer at Microsoft. So I'm build with, code with customers. So I'm out there deploying with customers. We tend to work with kind of the top 400 customers in the world across the globe. So I'm part of that commercial software engineering team. I've been at Microsoft about 2.5 years. I've come from the partner space. So I've been kind of deploy and all that good stuff. And I was brought up in the ops space and moved more into the development side. So I've actually transpired my career across those different technologies for quite some time, for over 20 years, actually.
Wow. That's a similar trajectory as me. Started in the ops space, do a little bit of dev, though I always like back away. I'm not a developer, but I do developy things. But obviously, I've read some of your blogs. I've seen some of your videos. I know that you're passionate about DevOps. I'm curious if there was some like inciting event that happened in your tenure that, you know, kind of kindled that passion, or was it just a gradual transition?
I actually had kind of two incidences in my life that really pushed me over that edge and really being passionate about DevOps. The first one was having an outage or having multiple outages and issues and losing infrastructure and then having to recover it for 3-4 days and having the fallout. And I tell this great story in a lot of my talks where I went away on holiday for 10 days, came back, and I got into my office Monday morning and I had zero technology with me. I was in the Bahamas. I had no phone, you know, no laptop, didn't care for anything in the world. Got back and I saw my manager first thing and he had been crying and he's a big, like, military looking guy. And I was like, "Hey, you okay?" He goes, no, we've lost everything. And I was like, "Yeah, you're funny." He's like, no, really. And he was serious. We had lost everything. And I got put in my chair, everyone handed me coffee and food, and I had to recover our infrastructure from ground zero. We had a SAN failure. And we kept having failures after that as well. And we had to patch our infrastructure together. And it was manual, it was painful. And I literally cried myself to sleep. So that was like, I need a change in my life. And that was coming from a, you know, a very Windows focused environment, big server farms, a lot of tier one applications. And that was my change point. That started making me look at the cloud and this whole thing of cloud. And cloud and DevOps are not the same thing. You can do DevOps not in the cloud, but it really started making me think we can do this differently. And the second piece for me was really getting into infrastructure as code. And I'm like, oh, we can automate this. And that started with ARM templates in Azure. As soon as I started embracing the cloud and looking at it, I'm like, oh, we can use PowerShell to automate these tasks in what was then Office 365. Then we can go into the cloud and automate stuff with ARM templates. Oh, there's something called Terraform. When I discovered Terraform, that was my life changer. That was like, right, I'm in. Like, we've got to do better. And it's having recovered applications, having worked with dev teams and having those pain points and having outages where I just banged my head against the wall repeatedly and not getting any better results. I'm like, there's got to be a better way. So those are my learning experiences. And I completely flipped from there.
Yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense. I have had similar experiences in my ops life where something traumatic happened. We had a data center outage once because they were doing an upgrade of the circuits and the generators for this hosted facility, and the transfer switch didn't work right. So the power was fine, the power was there, but when they went to go flip it from one to the other, it just didn't transfer properly, and all the power was out for a little over 30 minutes. And so all of our servers went down hard, all of them. Storage array went down hard. There were Sun servers that had probably been running for 3 to 4 years straight that went down hard, and it was just all hands on deck for the next 3 days trying to get everything back up and running. We lost a full file server, had to recover that and some other stuff. So I felt that pain. I know where you're coming from. You mentioned that you're from a Windows-centric background, or at least that was a Windows-centric background and an environment. People tend to kind of lump DevOps in with Linux. Mm-hmm. And because you're coming from that Windows background, did you encounter some difficulty adopting the existing DevOps tools out there, or was it a relatively easy transition for you?
I think ops people have it the hardest when it comes to a DevOps transformation. They always do. Because if you're a developer, like, you're putting code somewhere, you're developing with some code, you're writing in a language, you're doing something. And to a developer, that's kind of brought in from day one. As an ops person, you know, and we've transformed in the IT industry. You know, you think back to, I don't want to date any of us, but there was a point in time when we had DOS and command lines. And then we moved into this GUI thing with Windows, and it was awesome. But then we became a point and click kind of culture on the ops side. So when I really started doing more automation, I was using PowerShell. And, you know, I remember going to like a PowerShell 2.0 course, and we automated SharePoint, Exchange, everything. And as soon as I learned to automate with PowerShell, that was my entry point. But I feel ops people, you know, I've even worked with some younger people in the field that are, you know, fresh out of university, coming out of like a kind of a training program. And they're like, I don't know how to work Server 2003. Don't even talk to them about like Server 2000. And you're like, oh my God, I'm old. So there's, you know, everything's kind of coming full circle. You know, we were CLI, we're GUI, we're kind of moving back to the CLI, and PowerShell is so powerful. And so for the Windows people that did embrace PowerShell, I think, you know, there's some continuity there. But for a lot of people, yeah, we think DevOps, we think Linux, we think open source and not Microsoft. We don't think Windows. Like, Windows isn't open source. Why would we, you know, do that? It's not cool. But I think Microsoft has really changed that. And we have so many more open source products now, including PowerShell. But yeah, I think a lot of people also used to kind of think, well, I'm a Windows person or I'm a Linux person. And I got into a very heated debate with someone recently about, you know, I'm not a Windows or a Linux person anymore. I did come from a Windows background and I had Linux environments, but it's cool to be cross-platform now. And I think PowerShell shows that. PowerShell is, you know, for the Linux folk and the open source people, like, they're really embracing that. And they're some of the biggest embracers of PowerShell. And, you know, I'm no longer, I moved away from just being this Windows-centric person, but cross-platform is really good to people, especially surviving the industry when things change so much and being able to adapt as well.
You said cross-platform, like, so Ubuntu and Red Hat, like that?
In CentOS, come on.
Yeah. So April, you're going into a lot of different customers all the time in your role at Microsoft. And you talked about a bunch of different people types of, you know, the new ones coming out of college, folks that are a little older, like us, especially me. How do you categorize these different people that you see out there? And what are the categories that they fall into in this DevOps context?
I think most people, when we first interact with them, we engage with them, they want to do things the right way. And they see cloud as that enabler without question. And that's probably the first thing we see. Every customer goes, but we're so far behind.
They see cloud as that enabler because it's just infrastructure as code almost inherently?
It's a new start. So you think of most of your infrastructures that you've worked with, most organizations, you know, I don't work with startups. I work with pretty established organizations for the most part. They have organically grown and they built something on top of something else on top of something else. And they have this massive beast of an infrastructure. And they're trying to, you know, there are times when customers had 5-6 data centers in a country or across the globe or more, and, you know, in various countries. Now they're trying to consolidate and use the cloud to build in resiliency in a different way. So when we engage with the customer, it's usually on a key project and they go, you know, this is actually our clean slate. Like, we're going into a new place, i.e. a new data center in Azure. This is the time to use the cloud, use some automation, but we're so behind. Like, every customer sees these like amazing latest and greatest things we're doing in the cloud and we see in the industry, but they always think they're so behind. So I think generally every customer we interact with thinks they're massively behind the curve. And they're actually not. I mean, we have some customers that are using more legacy stuff than others, but I think a lot of customers are in a very, very similar place. We probably see more customers that are struggling to embrace DevOps and they're still at, like, you know, ground zero, versus customers that have really gotten on that path and really start to embrace it. So we tend not to categorize, but we try to find out where the starting point is and where can we start building it. So whenever we start a net new project, we go, right, let's start enveloping all these things into what we're doing now and starting the right way from the beginning, instead of trying to add things after and being that very DevOps-y mentality, let's do it from the get-go. So we really try to change their mental mindset off the bat.
Mm. That can be really challenging depending on the culture of the organization that you're stepping into. Do you kind of, because I know, like, people talk about DevOps as partly the culture and embracing some of the processes that are there. When you come into a new customer, do you get a feel for the company culture? And does that change the way that you would approach introducing DevOps to them?
Absolutely. I mean, when we get introduced into a project, we see a limited part of the organization, but we, most of the time, we see a lot of silos. So we might be working with a developer team, and they have to then go to the security team, and there's a lot of back and forth. So even from project kickoff of what we're trying to achieve, we're working through those silos constantly. So we're starting there, you know, and it's hard to take a massive organization and change that culture. And I think most importantly, it has to come from the top. And then, you know, trickle down, and it has to be led by example as well. While we try to lead on these projects, we have to get buy-in from the executives, and that's really tough. But if we can at least start shifting one part of the organization, that has a trickle down effect to the others. So a customer project I did recently went in, very siloed organization. And, you know, we are literally banging on every door to get everyone to work together and to get everything set up before we start coding, before we start deploying. And even that was a small project, and we had several developers on it with more coming in later on the project. The second iteration of that project has 20, 30 developers, but then will affect another several hundred in the organization. Yeah. So we start off with something really small, spent probably the first 4 months of a project dealing with the culture and the politics, for lack of a better phrase. And then that's gone into another reiteration where it's grown into this blossoming, beautiful Azure platform, right? And it's went from something really small to going, we've grown something really nice and a really cool product, and they're really pleased. So we had to really start chipping away in small ways. And it's hard because as a developer, you're like, oh, good, I get to deal with politics today or people moving or, you know, not code. So it's, you have to take a step back and go, what's the long-term goal? What are we trying to achieve? And kind of take that 10,000 foot view of the project. So it's definitely shifting the mentality of the heads down in code or deploying this virtual machine or this stuff and going, let's come up, what are we trying to achieve and work together? So
it's got to be easier to overcome that resistance when you're doing either greenfield, like, you know, it's a new app, and rather than do it on our existing infrastructure, we're going to stand it up in cloud this time. We're going to use DevOps techniques and so on. That's got to be a way easier scenario, or just converting something that's small, as opposed to, here's your legacy infrastructure that you all know and have been working on for years, and we're going to change all of that in the next 6 months. How does that feel for everybody? Not very good. So that greenfield approach with that's just got to overcome the resistance. And in my mind, once you've done that and you've had success, now you've got known processes, you've got a new way to deploy something that you've built confidence in, and it becomes easier at that point to retrofit older, if appropriate, to your existing and traditional apps and see if you can make them go in the new model too.
So I think I'm going to challenge you a little bit, Ethan. because everyone likes a challenge, right? Greenfield is easy, but it doesn't always achieve what we need to as an organization. Like, we can take net new and go greenfield and say, ah, this worked over here, but people will hold on as to their baby. Like, we have grown. If you've been in an organization for 5, 10 years, 20 years, or, you know, you own this product or this thing, the service you're delivering, you don't want to let go of it. So you're still going to face those other challenges when you go to those other environments, right? So we always try to pick what hurts most in an organization and start there. And that's the advice we give. So the platform that we replatformed in my previous example, we chose something that was a massive pain point. It seems small. And it, mm-hmm. to us as cloud professionals, you're like, oh, it's just a bunch of VMs and scripts. And it was super easy. But for the customer, it had such a massive impact. And it was a big problem. So we try to pick the problems that kind of hurt the most and start there, because it may be an app. And, you know, you try to break down a monolith and people are like, whoa, that's my baby. Don't break my baby. Don't rock the boat. We don't want to wake the baby. We must feed and water it this way. So but if you start those hard points, you can really like make the biggest impact in the organization. And that app that might be monolithic might have the biggest impact to your end users in delivering the greatest value to your organization as well. And that's really key.
Well, pain is another huge one, I guess. Yeah, sure. Because if it hurts a lot, you're more willing to make a change than if it's working fine, everything's good. No, if it sucks and it hurts and it's the sand that just went down and it keeps going down, then yeah, all of a sudden you are willing to make changes. So I get your point. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And I think also people are very conscious to say, I have this monolith, let's make it microservices. And I'm like, well, hold on, let's slow down. We don't necessarily need to make it microservices to achieve DevOps. We need to deploy more frequently to our monolith, but we don't necessarily need to break it down all the time and re-architect it. And there's times to re-architect, there's times to do other things. And it's, people always ask, oh, what would you do? And I'm like, it's a case by case basis. Like, we got to look at it. What are we trying to achieve and how do we get there? And what do we consider a success? Because you will have failures along the way and you have to be willing to accept those failures. And that's hard. That's really hard. Nobody likes to fail.
No. But it's definitely part of the process. That's one of the things that I had to learn, is if you are always taking the safe road or not changing anything for fear of failure, you're going to end up failing anyway, and you're not going to make any progress by failing in a non-changing kind of way. I'm curious, you know, when you're encountering some opposition from people who don't want to change, what are some approaches? Like, let's say I'm an internal champion, I'm working with you, and there's somebody else who's just, they're difficult and they love their storage array or they love their network and they don't want to change. How can I start to introduce some of these concepts in like a way that doesn't make them feel threatened? Because I think that's usually what it is. They feel like their job is being threatened in some way.
Absolutely. And I think nobody likes to feel like they lose a job. And it's always, whenever there's change in IT, massive changes, when virtualization came into play and we all started embracing virtualization, we're all like, oh my God, physical servers are going out. Well, they are, but not really. We still use them. So I think it's changing how people do things. So networking, I think, is kind of an easy one. So how many times have you mistyped an IP address? I'm like every day.
Always. Yeah. Always.
Yeah. Always. Like every day.
Today,
like every second
three
of
times.
The day. Yeah. Yeah. So
true, actually.
Yes. Like, I've mistyped IP addresses and, you know, you say to them, well, why do you mistype? And they're like, well, human error. And human error is the cause of a lot of our pain points. And when we start talking about, look, we don't want you to be reactive. We want to be proactive. It's starting to address those pain points with that person. So like, hey, we're not taking away your job, but what if you could deploy your IP addresses, you know, for your, whatever you need to deploy, and you can automate that. And actually you could go do cool things and not have to worry about this reactive stuff, because it's having the hammer thrown down on you and getting all those bad days out of the way and trying to have better days and focus on what you should be doing. Cause you hear a lot of times with internal, you know, either sysadmins or someone that's really protective, a network administrator, well, this is my baby and I'll be redundant. No, you're not going to be redundant, but we want you to be proactive. The biggest thing in organizations, and this is really tough as part of the culture change, is how are they incentivized? You know, if your ops team and your dev teams are incentivized differently, and we need to deliver value to our end users and our customers, we can't deliver the same thing if we're incentivized differently. If ops teams, networking teams are monitored on uptime, if you're like, right, your bonus, or you know, you're basically going to keep your job, or you get a bonus if everything's up 24/7 by 365 or 99.995, whatever the SLA is in the organization, and the dev team is feature, 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 These are two conflicting things. So we need to align also what the business is delivering to the teams, and that helps. So if you say to, you know, Mr. and Mrs. networking person, you know, we're going to incentivize you to deliver X to the team and not, you know, and take out that downtime piece, and you incentivize that, that makes them go, okay. Sometimes money talks, or maybe it's a day off, or it's some kind of incentivization for them to say, I've earned this and I'm going to work towards it. So, and that leadership needs to lead with that as well. And when they start seeing the leadership and the other teams embracing that, it starts to chip away at that. And it can be a really long, hard road. But you have to change the culture, but open as well, be really open to conversation. And that person that is having a difficult time, you know, what is bothering you? And I have a very open relationship with my manager. I tell him when something's wrong, when I'm not happy with something, and we work through it. And that open communication piece is really key. So the culture piece is hard, but the most important piece, because the technology is easy, you know?
It is, and it's not, especially when you're first getting to know whatever the technology is. There's an aspect of you don't know what you don't know. If you're an engineer, particularly a responsible, conscientious one, you're worried that you're going to do the wrong thing or not know about a thing. It's going to cause something to break, an outage, and you're going to be held responsible for that. And there's always that fear. If you know your legacy stuff, let's say, really well, and you're very confident in your ability to operate that stuff, you don't want to make a change unless there's a really good reason. I think that's a lot of it for a lot of people, just that. And I know technology, I've actually written about this very recently. Technology is change. That's part of what we deal with as technologists. But still, the fear of getting called out if you blow something up without meaning to, is that's a big thing.
Fear drives us, though. And when we start to fear something more, we start to mess up more. You know, I'm afraid to make this change, so I'm just going to back off. And actually, it can cause more issues. I mean, you know, it's avoiding the inevitable or something, or someone else makes the same error that you could have made. You go, phew, okay, person over there made the mistake. I didn't. I'm off the hook. But we don't want to throw our colleagues under the bus. So why was that change not made by, you know? So, but then you can also be the hero and the rock star by figuring something out. And that's the other thing, too, as technology changes. Like, we're all in this industry for different reasons, right? I mean, I love the rate of change. The rate of change is also really scary, especially when you look at the cloud and how much is coming out there. But yes, there's lots of new things, but the fundamentals are there. And everyone starts from not knowing anything. And that's okay. Like, I didn't know anything about Terraform the day I was like, oh, what is this Terraform thing? I had no idea. And I had to make mistakes. I just made sure not to deploy those to production. But for me, it was that changing mentality to go, I can deploy this. I can check what I'm going to do before I push that big red button, because I have rebooted a server or a server farm or a cluster before because the names looked similar and I was tired. It was 3 a.m. or I just had a bad day. But by being able to run checks against your checks, whether they're visual and you know, automate anything you can, that's taken away a lot of my errors. I mean, to be fair, I haven't rebooted a server unknowingly in a while, actually. We've done really well with that. So yeah, and I'm still gainfully employed for this week. There's so much change.
I say that, you know, you're not real sysadmin until you've taken something down in production during the day. I mean, that's table stakes. You got to do that at least once.
At least once a year. No.
Yeah. You were talking about incentives, and I thought that was really interesting. It resonated with me in my experience. My second tech job, I was a sysadmin, and one of the things we were judged on was uptime of different systems throughout the year. And I had a bonus that was directly tied to our uptime. So I would try to maximize that uptime as much as possible. And when the application guys wanted to push out an update in the middle of the day because it was a really important feature or something, I'd be like, no, we have to wait till after hours because that doesn't count towards my downtime. And that would be very frustrating for them. And I understand. I forget who said this. It might be Charity Majors, but basically your uptime doesn't matter if your customers aren't getting the features and functionality that they want. I'm paraphrasing, but that was basically the gist of it. So I was incentivized to keep things up, not keep things improving. they could have structured it in a way that both of us got what we wanted.
Yeah, and I'm measured currently on, is the customer happy? And people are like, well, what metrics can I use? Because, you know, a lot of times when you're reporting metrics, you have to report how many lines of code did this developer deploy? So saying, is the customer happy, is a really hard metric, right?
Yeah.
And we have things that we use, you know, how was I participating in sprints? Was I deploying code? You know, what was the team sharing the, you know, what we were doing in that phase of the code? But, you know, when we look at how Microsoft's, you know, different teams in Microsoft work, I mean, I've had customers and partners say, well, we want to measure our developers. And I'm like, well, okay, but you start measuring, they're going to find a way around the system. So in my team specifically, we develop quality over quantity. So if I'm in the middle of a sprint or I have a feature to get out or I'm deploying some infrastructure, if it slips because I found a problem or something wasn't ready, I say, right, hand up, this wasn't ready. I need more time. I tell them how much time I need. And if it's a bug or something we need to address, we do that. But I will absolutely raise my hand and say, I'm not going to get this done by the end of the sprint. I can't get this deployed. We're having some weird issue with Key Vault and Azure, and you know, it's not right. And it doesn't deliver what the customers requested or what they're expecting. So it doesn't delay what we're doing. It delayed some automation stuff. It was, you know, but it didn't have an impact, didn't have an outage. I could have deployed it. It would have been insecure. I could have rushed it out the door. And a lot of times we do rush things to meet a deadline, and that's hard. And that is part of the cultural change, to be able to raise your hand and say, this isn't ready. We can't push it. But yeah, I'm incentivized. Is the customer happy, basically? Is the customer happy? You know, they don't take a poll or anything, but genuinely, yeah. Did the project go well? How do we contribute? How did we share? What did we learn? And it's important to how we measure people. Because if you have to measure a developer on lines of code or an ops person on how much ops time, uptime they had, you know, you're going to get, you know, those silos will be dug even greater in the ground and there'll be bigger fights.
There's no place like :1. There's no place like :1. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, you might want to consider some IPv6 training, because make no mistake, if you're working in cloud, IoT, or security, IPv6 is part of your life. Hexabuild helps large organizations successfully adopt IPv6 through comprehensive training and education. But if you don't work at a large organization, don't worry. One of their open enrollment classes can work for you. Just visit their website at hexabuild.io and click on the training link. There's a myriad of ways that IPv6 can impact your work and your organization. Maybe your company is using AWS to develop a mobile application, or you are managing disparate networks from mergers and acquisitions. IPv6 could be a blind spot in your organization's security landscape, or you might just be struggling to make do with an ever-dwindling supply of public and private IPv4 address space. A solid plan for IPv6 adoption and training can help, and that is where Hexabuild comes in, by providing education and training for you and your team on IPv6, professional services and consulting on your IPv6 initiatives, and assessments, audits, workshops, and more to help your team effectively learn and use IPv6. If this sounds interesting to you, we've got a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Go to training.hexabuild.io and use the discount code PACKETPUSHERS, all one word, to get your 10% discount and some sweet free stickers. I know I'm in it for the stickers and the IPv6 knowledge too. Once again, that's training.hexabuild.io and use the discount code PACKETPUSHERS.
April, I wanted to go back to a point you made earlier where you said a lot of us feel like we're really far behind, and we're really not, but it does, the cycle of change is very quickly here, and it does feel like if I'm not deploying serverless apps on dynamic infrastructure using CI/CD pipeline and Rust, I'm not really DevOpsing. Is there, I mean, you're arguing that's not true. So why isn't that true? Because man, it really does feel that way.
It does feel that way. And it's, we get information overload. So, you know, I use Twitter a lot, and I use Twitter because I can see a snippet of what's been released. And we're releasing new features. So if you're kind of keeping up on, you know, TechCrunch or any of the news articles, you see a lot come out and you see people talk about new things. You go to any kind of online event or user group, you see new things and like, oh, this is great. The new features are there, but it isn't right for everyone. And that's the thing, you know, it's like containerization. Every customer's like, oh, I want to containerize this. I'm like, do you need to containerize it? Like, we could make this a microservices. I mean, when you go to architect a system, it's good to look at what is really there and what it needs to do and what you're trying to achieve out of that. And yeah, it's hard because we see all these new things, but yes, the technology is there, but we don't always need that specific technology. We may want it, but it's not a need. It's kind of like, you know, when you were a child and you're like, I want candy. And your parents are like, you don't need candy. You're like, yes, I do. They're like, no, you want candy. It's kind of like that with customers. Sometimes we have to go back and say, do we need this? But yeah, there's a phenomenal rate of change. And there's so much we can do. I mean, it isn't just standing up a server anymore and going, yep, there's our box. There we go. Everything is a lot more dynamic. And I think that's important. So if we can kind of future-proof what we are deploying to be more dynamic, that will help us in the long run. So for instance, you know, if I have my infrastructure as code, I can change, i.e. that code pretty easily. I can tear down my infrastructure, rebuild it, deploy it somewhere else. It changes how we talk about DR and backup. It changes how we talk about the different services we're utilizing. So it is fast and it is ever moving. But if we kind of start upgrading, not upgrading, but really modernizing some of our infrastructure, we have that capability to kind of change and do things. But yeah, there's absolutely a lot of great things coming to the cloud, which is fantastic, but it is so overwhelming.
So I want to drill into the, do we actually need the thing? How do you make that determination? A lot of it's driven by developers, I think, and release cycles. Is there something there? Are there other guidelines you can give people to help them determine whether they need the thing, whatever it is?
So I think when you start a project or you have this idea and you want to do something, I mean, it's great. You can build out a sandbox and test it in Azure and then just destroy it, right? For pretty much minimal cost. I think this is the great thing about the cloud. I can build something, test and go, nope, this doesn't work. Take it down, you know, a few hours later. And that's something we didn't have when we were strictly on-prem before or in data centers, especially a hosted data center. We had to wait to spin up a server. So this ability to change is nice. But when you look at what someone wants, why do we want to do it? Why do we need to go to that technology? And it is going to be very much an architectural decision. What are the pros and cons? And it's very simply listing out the pros and the cons. Like, what feature benefits do we get? You know, when you look at PaaS or software as a service in Azure, you know, I've sat in front of customers and like, oh, we built this custom app. We want to get in the cloud. It runs on this many VMs. We need resiliency. I'm like, hold on a second. What does this app do? Oh, it's a mapping program. Oh, we have Azure Maps, you know, and it ticked all their boxes. So it's literally what do we need? What are our wants? And if we have a product that does it, we're like, here you go. You know, like, it may not be perfect out of the box, but it gets them a lot further than where they are today. Just to change something for the sake of change, what are we getting out of it? Pain, tears, sweat, blood, you know? So realistically, like, what benefits are we getting out of that product?
You're saying don't chase the hype cycle, chase whether or not you actually need a thing, like any other technology evaluation any of us have done for years and years and years.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, we have customers that move to the cloud and virtual machines, and that's great, but not very nimble. And there's a use case for virtual machines, but I always look at customers and go, right, can we put this into a platform as a service? Can we go microservices or serverless when and where it's possible? But I don't want to leave with microservices because it's the hot new thing. And yes, it's great, it's awesome, but it's not always the right thing.
Yeah. And the nice thing about the cloud that you mentioned is if you do want to play with the new shiny and you don't have a good business use case for it yet, you can experiment for like lower, almost no cost with a lot of these things. See if it does meet some unknowable need, because there's the like the unknown unknowns that you have to explore, and you're not losing, you're not moving your production app to that thing and realizing, oh, this doesn't fit at all.
And it's low entry point, right? So I see a lot of ops teams or developers start to have a play with the technology and go, yeah, I've built this. And I've had some really intelligent people that I've worked with. We're like, you know, we either do like a hackathon at Microsoft or some kind of learning thing. They're like, you know, we have a great use case for this in our organization. I've gone and built it. And like, they'll go show the exec team. The exec team's like, wow. And then there's always discussion around cost and functionality and features and all that good stuff. But I've seen some people that get the light bulb moment. And when you get that light bulb moment, build something really cool. I mean, you know, we talk about all the different stuff out, you know, there's GitHub Actions, there's CI/CD pipelines with all sorts of different technologies. You know, go have a play with it. And you kind of have this light bulb moment, go, actually, I know how I can use this. And even something small, you know, that entry point is really low compared to where it used to be, where you had to go buy hardware, have a sandbox environment, and And then you get yelled at because you need that sandbox environment for production, you know, because you're out of space. So
when you say, I know how I can use this, that's the magic for me always right there. As soon as it like, I have a use case for this, then it's like, okay, I'm off to the races. Let's figure this out.
Yeah, let's make it happen. And I see so many developers and operations people that are in the organization that can then go to the exec team or someone in the business and get buy-in for their idea. And that's phenomenal. And that's making change from the bottom up instead of the top down. And I love seeing that. I absolutely love seeing that developer operational enablement in the cloud where someone says, I have this idea, I've built something. You know, we have customers come to Hacks and they go show the SLT, the senior leadership team, what they've done. And they're making the change in the organization. And I love seeing it when people get that light bulb moment and they just like, you see them, they're like a jet plane. They just take off and they're like, I figured it out. Look at this. It does this, this, this. And they're like, and I love that excitement, you know, and you could be the quietest person in the room sometimes. And they're like, they just have this, they built something amazing. You're like, take that. And like, how can I support you? And it's awesome. It's awesome to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had this experience so many times where I read the marketing materials and I think I kind of understand the product. And then I read the docs and I'm like, I'm a little bit closer, but I don't ever really understand a product until I get hands-on. I start tinkering around with it. I'm like, oh, that works completely different than I had in my mind. And sometimes that's a bonus. Like, yes, okay, I see this use case that I didn't see before. And sometimes it's like, oh, this is not going to fit what I was looking for at all. But it's never really clear for me, at least, until I get that hands-on sort of experience with it. I'm curious, because things change so much and the cloud and even on-prem technologies are such a broad swath of things, Do you try to keep up with everything? Do you specialize in one specific thing? Do you take the sort of the trident approach to it? What would your advice be regarding that?
I think this also kind of ties back to what you guys were saying about, you know, the people that are really conscious of their jobs, like having a siloed role. I really challenge people to come out of their silo. Silos are so 10 years ago. And I understand why. It's great to be a subject matter expert, but you need to have other skill sets to really thrive in the industry, especially with the speed of change. And I'm a Swiss Army knife. When people ask me about my skill set, I'm like, I'm a Swiss Army knife. I'm like, I've had to architect and design and deploy massive data centers, everything from the networking, like literally the firewalls, the WAN firewalls, all the way into the software stack, into how databases are working. And I have literally had to go like from the very top down in, which I think's benefited my career. But having that knowledge, like I do specialize in certain things, but I would never say, I hate the phrase expert. Someone the first time called me a Terraform expert and I just looked at him. I was like, Terraform. It freaked me out. Yeah. It's because I understand how much there is to know about it. I respect that. Right. So I have the respect that I'm never going to know everything about Terraform. And I like to compliment people will. So people that are very siloed and specialized, that's great. Start learning other things, whether it's a new language or another technology or how something interacts with something else in the environment. And I think that's really important, especially for longevity of your career, because you can then have those conversations of, you know, well, this is how my app interacts with this, or this is how my networking or my storage interacts. And actually these are the dependencies. And actually that's really, really important to know. So I always encourage people to learn more, and especially when learning the cloud, people go, where do I start? And I'm like, whatever makes you happy. But realistically, the Azure Fundamentals course on Microsoft Learn is fantastic. You learn the basics. And then I tell people, then go off and learn like AI or some technology stack that really, really interests you, whether it be Azure DevOps or, you know, networking related or security related, et cetera. I said, there's so many free modules. So learn the basics, understand how things work, and then just start picking areas. And I will occasionally pick up topics I don't know that make me really uncomfortable. Like I wouldn't go in front of a customer and talk about them, but I will take some time and learn it myself. So I'm actually learning one right now, and I'll be open and transparent with this. One of the projects I'm working on involves video indexer technology in Azure. Hmm. I know of it. I know how it works. I haven't actually used it, and I'm working on a project with it. So I'm actually going and I'm spending time how to learn that. And there are other parts of things that may hook into AI and ML, and there are areas that I haven't dug into massively. I know some of the products, I know some of the features, and I've hooked some things in. But now I'm really going a lot deeper in it. And that's where I'm actually spending a lot of my time, because they're hooking into what I'm doing on the development side.
Are you working on a personal project or managing enterprise infrastructure? You know, if so, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions that allow you to take that project to the next level. You can simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. Want to get started with Linode today? You can get $100 in free credit just for listeners of the Day 2 Cloud podcast. Just go to linode.com/day2cloud. That's D-A-Y, the number 2, cloud. Linode has 11 global data centers and provides 24/7/365 human support with no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. That's pretty convenient. In addition to shared and dedicated compute instances, you could use that $100 in credit on S3 compatible object storage, managed Kubernetes, and more. Host your website, build your app, store or backup media. You know what? It's up to you. You can do whatever you want. It's all free with that $100 of Linode credit. So how do you get started? Go and visit linode.com. That's linode.com/day2cloud, D-A-Y, the number 2, cloud, and click on create free account to get started. And be sure to check out Linode's new YouTube channel for video tutorials, security tips, and more at youtube.com/Linode. And you know what? You might even see a familiar face. One more time, that's linode.com/day2cloud to get your free $100 in Linode credit.
You think there's a use case for ops people to get into AI and ML? You brought that up and I went, wait a minute. I mean, I think of that typically as someone who is doing a lot of data management. They have some specific application for AI, and I don't see those too often for ops folks. I mean, there's tooling that uses AI. I understand that. But really, for us on the end, doing the thing, what do you think?
Doing the thing? Yeah. I see a lot of data people with AI and ML, absolutely. So people that might have been like a SQL database specialist are really starting to learn the AI side of it. And that's a good transformation. But yeah, for the ops side, I mean, you can hook in AI into a lot of the Azure platform. So you might have an application or you're managing an infrastructure and you want to get more out of it. Like, we actually want to get more out of this. We're moving to the cloud. There are things you can hook in to make things better. So I used to do a demo with a Twitter tag. So people would tweet at me, I'd have whatever Twitter tags, I put Azure and, you know, whatever, Azure is awesome or something. And my sentiment analysis would take that it would pull my Twitter feed, take that, pull it in and put, it would do an emotion checker on it and go, right, this is a positive or negative tweet. And then it would alert if it was negative. And now you think as an infrastructure person, why do I care? If you think you're running maybe infrastructure for an organization that has a marketing department and the social media presence is really important, putting a negative or positive feedback onto what's being said means they can respond immediately. So instead of building out a system and like forwarding them thousands of emails a day or finding a way to put a hook into like Twitter or their social media presence, we can use that AI piece to say, we have sentiment analysis and we can say what our customer feedback is. So instead of building out an infrastructure, I've taken a serverless component. It runs a poll every 30 seconds or 2 minutes. We can set that up and it's serverless. So as an ops person, I don't have to manage that per se. I mean, I have monitoring around it, but I'm not managing that infrastructure. I've provided a service to our marketing team and I've enhanced that end user experience from something really small and easy to build in a matter of minutes. And then I can script that and automate that as the ops person and manage it. But I don't have to manage an operating system. I don't have to manage, antivirus. I don't have to worry about backup and DR because it's built into the product, but it provides a really cool service. But I manage, that the service is up in Azure and I have monitoring on it, but I don't actually have to do the day-to-day.
Hmm. Yeah. We talked about like customers and being worried about being behind and everybody's kind of starting at a different spot. So I wanted to talk about some organizations that you may have worked with and sort of what the next phase looks like for their journey. So like if you go into an org and they're an absolute beginner, if you can think of a time you've gone in and they've got nothing in the cloud, how do they get started? What's the first step for them?
So I think for them, they're thinking the technology. They think, we have technology to move over here. Let's get it over there. And I would say the lift and shift mentality was really popular. And we do still see customers do it. If they're like, my data center contract's ending in 6 months, I've got to get everything out of there. I don't want to extend. It's going to save me, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a month or whatever the, you know, the costs are. There's that lift and shift component. So whenever we see a customer that's like, we're going to the cloud, where do we start? Again, it's that cultural mindset and like, what are we trying to achieve? And that's always what we're asking is, what do we consider, what's our definition of done? And what are we trying to achieve? And how we get there is going to be a journey. But we need to make that cultural shift within the team of also why we're going to the cloud. You know, so organizations that opt to go there, again, well, the cloud's the hot topic. Okay, well, is there a financial reason, whatever? And a lot of times there's a financial reason, let's be honest. You know, customer, you know, wants to save X amount, or someone's shown them, you know, a sales team goes in and shows them that they can save X amount. They probably can. But if that's the only driver, we need to address a lot more than that. If that's, you know, so I think it's really looking at the cultural change. It's looking at all the technologies and finding the right fit, and looking at the transformation then and there, and not just throwing it up there and I'll do it later. It's getting them to think, we have a cultural change. We're going to the cloud. Let's start making the changes we need now, like security implementation, you know, all these tooling. Let's do that now in the beginning. And that's part of DevOps. You know, we're shifting left. And there's so many good reasons to shift left, and we can go on and on, have lists about that, but that's really key.
So the shift left thing, I've heard that before, and it didn't really make sense to me the first time I heard it. Cause like, I was like, where's left? Where are we shifting? Okay. What does it mean? So for listeners out there that have heard this term before and kind of come away scratching their head, when you say shift left, what does that mean?
So I like to sometimes show like a little pretty graph. Okay. And we have stats. We have stats about DevOps. So like, you know, people talk about DevOps as a theory. And I said, well, DevOps is a practice, and we have actual stats to know how DevOps works and what these companies are actually achieving by embracing DevOps. So, you know, we can pull those numbers forward. But when we talk about, you know, shifting left, a customer is doing, you're doing something. If you think of a graph, you know, I show my hands up, but I'm probably going to do it on the wrong side. You're doing everything in production. Oh, I'll fix that later approach. I'll do it later. So you're making changes in production or after the fact. So you get this giant, huge hump in production of issues, cost, increased cost to fix, outage times, et cetera. We know that over 85% of errors occur in the code. You start the code on the left-hand side of that graph. So if we start addressing errors in the code before they get to production, we implement testing, we do all these right DevOps steps to get there. We do everything early and often, and we fail fast. You know, so we implement something early and often, we fail fast, we know that didn't work, we get it right, and then we go to production. We don't do it, oh, I'll just do it later, because that I'll do it later means it gets forgotten. And it's something as simple as if you've built a server by hand, and you have a password somewhere, and you're like, yeah, I'm just going to put in this text file on the desktop of the server. And everybody's happy. Maybe it's like the SQL database password, or I don't know, the admin password, because I've seen that. And you're like, oh, I'll just do this later. Oh, you know what? I forgot to harden this server properly. Ah, I'll just do it later. It's working. It's been delivered to the dev team because I had a time crunch. You know, if we say, right, let's automate this, and we have a known working script, whether that be in PowerShell, whether that be in Python, if you're working in VMware, or even it's in Terraform or ARM templates, you write the script, you have a hardened version of your server, it's tested, and then you deploy to production, you have a known good working product. So we've shifted left. We've started doing everything before production, before it gets deployed. We start testing it. We make it, we're really thorough and do our due diligence before it goes out.
Right. And I would imagine the more mature the organization gets, the further they're able to shift some of these processes to the left and incorporate them more often.
Well, yes. Something else has popped in my head too. If we're shifting left and we all of a sudden failing fast doesn't sound so bad in that scenario, it's no longer the butt of a joke. It's the thing you actually want to do since you're doing it before production. Yep, let's get it done. Let's get this thing to a mature state so that we can release it. Doing it before production, failing fast, okay at that point.
Absolutely. So it takes that scary, we've deployed it and everyone's, you know, heads down, fingers and toes crossed, praying or meditating that nothing is going to break and you still have a job tomorrow. We go and we test it. We know it works. We can stand it up, you know, break it down, whatever we need to do, and then go, right, now we're ready. And that means we can iterate faster and faster. So yes, it takes time to script everything. Yes, it takes time to build it. But we know, you know, it takes us, let's say, 4 hours to deploy and harden a VM manually. Well, now we can deploy it in 45 seconds because we have a known working template. So when we get asked to deploy a virtual machine, we have a template, we push it out. Yeah, okay, your server's done, it's hardened, off you go. And we have all the security protocols in there that we need. Everything's configured and there's no manual processes. Now, there might still be a manual process. That's okay. There are still sometimes manual requirements in these processes, maybe in your first couple of iterations of automating as well. That's okay. But we've started to automate it and we've gone from a 4 hour deploy time to a 45 minute hardened template. So that's a massive difference.
Not only that, it's a force multiplier. So instead of taking 4 hours to deploy each and every VM that you get a request for, now you can deploy 30 of those in 45 seconds all in parallel.
Yeah. And I actually do a demo. It's in Azure and it's using Terraform and I deploy a VM scale set. And in my demo, I have 5 virtual machines. And then I'm like, right, I'm going to change, you know, I want to deploy 25 VMs. And I literally type in 25. I hit okay. We hit Terraform, you know, apply. And I go into the portal and you see 25 VMs deploying. And you see it scale out and it takes a couple minutes for the VMs to actually come up. But I would say within about, let's say 5 to 6 minutes, I've deployed 25 VMs.
Right.
Done.
Couldn't imagine doing that with VMware back in the day. I mean, you could always script it, but that you were so used to just right-clicking on the template and deploying it and next. And just that doesn't...
And then you're tired of it.
Yeah.
And you're going through like, all right, I'm bored of this. I'm hungry. I need to go home. And you hurry it and you rush it. And that's mm-hmm. where the human error comes in. Because I don't know about you guys. Yeah. Exactly. Like I get hangry and I'm like, I can't deal. I just get through this. And that's the hangry for me is my downfall or the like super exhaustion. But the hangry is like, that's when I make my mm-hmm. most mistakes. So I know I have to stop, go do something else, come back to it. But yeah, or I automate it. And then I automate it, go get a cup of tea as the Brits would do. And my biscuit, come back, done. And then I haven't been hangry. I haven't misdeployed anything. And everyone is happy.
Right. You mentioned the thing about leaving the password in a notepad file, like on the desktop of a server. And it just made me laugh because I absolutely did that in the past. And it makes me cringe now. But yeah, there was a time when I was like, well, nobody else is logging into the server. It's fine. I can just leave it here. It's just, like you said, the SQL database password. It's the SA password. I'll be fine.
Nobody will find this. It'll be fine. And then you get a breach. And I think one of the really important things about DevOps too, that's really key. And I've been talking a lot about securing DevOps because nobody wants to talk about security. We've all been in a room and the security person's banging on about, I need this secured. And you're like, I just need to get this over the line. But if we start securing things a little bit sooner, again, and that's kind of that still DevOps mentality, you know, how long does it take us to respond to events? That's the other thing, because we're going to have a breach. We're going to have a meltdown in our environment. So if we're implementing DevOps, how fast can we recover? And the Terraform example was really good. So I've had an issue in my environment. I've lost, let's say, West Europe data center, right? They've had a massive outage. I can take that Terraform script, change my variable to either North Europe or UK South, deploy it out, and my infrastructure is back up and running. Now, granted, not all my apps might be there, but if I have a full CI/CD pipeline going with my apps included and their deployments, I can make that repeatable. And that changes that DR conversation as well when you do have that outage. And that's a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's shifting left, adding in the security and all that kind of good stuff ahead of time. That's just going to save you a lot of headache and potential downtime once you actually roll.
And keeping the security people happy.
That is nice. I worked with a gentleman. His name is Lucas. I won't give last names, but Lucas was our security guy. And he was known to be the one that would break everything when we were ready to deploy. Because he'd be like, oh, no, you have to turn that on. You have to enable that. And I need logging here. And we would do all those things. And then suddenly the thing that we've been testing in the development environment, it didn't work anymore. And like, I don't know why it didn't occur to us to just bring Lucas in earlier. Come on, Lucas. Help us out.
Because everyone's scared of Lucas. Nobody wants to hear what Lucas has to say. Because you're like, Lucas is going to come in again and make our lives hell. Like, you know that, like, because he's going to pick all the things that, and developers don't want to think about security. Operations people don't want to think about security. But when you're doing DevOps right, and you're thinking about those things, you're A, shifting left, B, you're addressing it early. And it opens up that Swiss Army knife of skill sets a bit. And you make Lucas happy, but you also are doing it right from the get-go. And then you're not getting the knock on your door and hauled into your boss's office, getting yelled at. And you're just like, oh, here we go again. Yeah. So there's a lot of benefits to embracing those technologies early on. But yeah, no one wants to bring in Lucas early on because security scares us. We don't care about security.
Oh, we do when Lucas shows up.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think we are coming up on time here. It's been a great conversation, April. If you wanted to leave the listener with a few key takeaways, what would those things be?
I think, you know, when we talk about DevOps, and we didn't explicitly define it today as such, but I kind of mentioned, you know, delivering value. When we define DevOps, we talk to companies and we talk to people about how they define DevOps. We get very different answers. And a lot of that's based off of our experience. But I think you have to really think of DevOps as being focused around, and it really requires input from the people. So there's that culture change. The process, what is your process? You know, what does it look like? Failing fast and doing these things and shifting left. And also the tooling. And we really need these three things, and not one of them in of themselves will be that magic bullet for us. Mm-hmm. And we need to really deliver value, you know. So I know you're, you know, a developer, I know you're ops. Are you delivering value? And think about that every time we go through this process. What's the value we're delivering? And DevOps never stops. Like, people think, oh, when's the end? I'm like, yes, we have a definition of done in our project when the project is done, but we can always improve things. So DevOps is cyclical and it's always, always happening. And we're going to continue improving as we go, especially as, you know, we talked about technology going million miles a minute. New technology comes out or something comes out that we need to address, or maybe a feature benefit to something we're doing in the cloud. Because we're a high-performing or high-achieving DevOps organization, we can make that change, and we're agile, we can do that. And that's really important.
All right. Great summary. And you know, keep those points in mind, listener, when you're going on that DevOps journey, because it's going to pay dividends in the end. I can promise that, at least. If folks want to know more about you, if they want to find you online, what are some good resources to check out?
So I keep a blog. I'm on Twitter. So you can always follow me on Twitter at the April Edwards. I'm also on LinkedIn. I always tell people, you know, please feel free to reach out to me. Send me a, you know, tweet at me, get me on LinkedIn. I'm never very responsive on email just because my inbox is a mess because I haven't DevOps that yet. But I always put out blog posts and videos on Channel 9. So my website is azapril.dev.
Awesome. Well, if you ever figure out how to DevOps your inbox, you'd come back on. You got to let us know.
I'll let you know. You first.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, April, so much for being a guest today on Day 2 Cloud.
Thanks for having me.
And hey, virtual high fives to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we'd love to hear them. Hit either of us up on Twitter at ecbanks or at ned1313, or you can fill out the form on my fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. If you like engineering-oriented shows like this one, why not visit packetpushers.net/subscribe? All of our podcasts, newsletters, and websites are there. It's all nerdy content designed for your professional career development. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.